Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Winnipeg sculptor Warren Carther, highly recognized for his innovative large-scale glass sculptures that put him at the forefront of the contemporary glass sculpting movement. Warren studied at the School of Art in Winnipeg, the Naples Mills School of Arts and Crafts in New York, and graduated from the California College of the Arts, where he studied glass blowing with one of the founders of the American Studio Glass Movement, Marvin Lipovsky. Warren has created more than 100 site-specific installations nationally and internationally, such as Winnipeg's One Canada Place and our international airport, the Canadian embassies in London, as well as in Tokyo, the Anchorage International Airport in Alaska, Lincoln House in Hong Kong, and Charles de Gaulle's airport in France, and more. His works have been exhibited widely and are in the collections of several museums, such as the Winnipeg Art Gallery, the Philadelphia National Liberty Museum, the Derricks Gallery in Germany, and the Museum of Contemporary Design and Applied Arts in Switzerland. His vibrant glass architectural sculptures have been featured in many books on international contemporary architectural glass, and he is often invited to speak about his work and related topics. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, very nice to be here.
Thank you. Your vibrant sculpture, Aperture, the Winnipeg Airport, is a remarkable site-specific piece that captures the natural lighting like a prism from the wall of windows in front of it and frames the prairie landscape that stretches almost endlessly from the view. Can you tell us about the process and dialogues that bring this piece to life?
Sure. Well, the process is one where I actually build up three-dimensionally with the glass by utilizing multiple layers. Each sheet of glass is very thick at 19 millimeters, and then they're bonded to create a sculptural form. So the bonding is done with an optically clear adhesive, and we do that in my studio using a variety of techniques that are actually kind of hard to describe. They're easier to show than they are to talk about, but the pieces are all solid, and they're lit from below. After the pieces have been stacked, the process is to carve them with an abrasive blast, which is a type of a sandblaster, mm-hmm. a very large and powerful one, which allows me to manipulate the form further after I've combined the pieces. So traditionally in sculpture, regardless of what material you use, the creation of the form is usually done by an additive or a subtractive process. And so to create these forms, I first add by building up the layers, and then I subtract by carving into them.
Aperture has departed somewhat from your other works, and are you excited about the direction you see this taking your work moving forward?
Yeah, it is quite a departure in terms of its scale, but the building up of layers is actually something that has been incorporated in my work since the 90s. I think the first project that I used that in would have been the Canadian Embassy in Tokyo. And it's a very small part, but a very significant part of that project. It's the layers are down at the bottom of the piece, so not immediately obvious, but they contain a very significant part of the concept of the piece. And the current works that I'm doing also involve this multiple lamination process, but again, they're different. And my work changes due to the context that it's in, since a lot of my work is public art, and context is really important. The environment that the piece is going to sit in permanently really kind of dictates how I might approach the piece and what techniques I use. So yeah, but Aperture was definitely a breakthrough, and I'm wanting to do more pieces of multiple layers on that scale.
What do you envision your viewers may see and feel when they experience or interact with your sculptures?
Well, I hope they're going to get a sense of place, of where they are. I hope that they're going to also bring into it some imagination and to let their mind wander through the piece. I've given a lot of clues as to what it is that I would like people to see in each individual project, but I also leave them a lot of room for their imaginations to roam. I think that if you supply all the information, that the piece is much less interesting. That if you allow the viewers to look into the piece and to discover things for themselves, I think it has more meaning for them as well. And actually, I really enjoy that process. It kind of develops a relationship between the artist and the viewer. I've had several people at different times tell me that what they see in the piece, and I love it, and then I take that on as part of the piece. So the piece continues to grow in a way. I've also had people get it completely wrong, and that can be a bit of a challenge, but it makes me smile sometimes in the way that it can be interpreted.
What are some of the other elements and concepts that inform and inspire designs?
I think, as I mentioned, context is one of the most important ones. But I've had different life experiences that feed into my aesthetic considerations. I think one of the strongest ones was when I was actually just prior to going to art school. I had worked in a gold mine in northern Ontario near the border. And I found that world to be very beautiful and mysterious, so very stark and cold. But I didn't work there for very long, but I was there for about 6 months. And basically, I was doing a lot of drilling and blasting. And so the mine fills with dust and smoke. And you wear a light on your hard hat. And through the smoke, every once in a while, something of color would show up. And there wasn't very much down there that was colored. Everything was kind of gray. But once in a while, they had drilled into the side of the wall, and water would come out, and it would wash the stone and show off metal oxides. And the light from your helmet would pick up the glistening of the water and the color of the metal oxide. And it was just astonishing to me. So a number of my pieces, particularly my early work, kind of worked with that aesthetic so that the colors were very subdued, but then there would be one or two places where colors would just pop out. So that's sort of been a color aesthetic that stayed with me. I also experienced the same thing going to school in San Francisco when the fog would roll in and you'd be driving around and a fire hydrant or a yellow Volkswagen or something would pop out of the fog. And so that, I don't know, those ideas just have stayed with me forever.
That desire to have the really vibrant colors, is that why you chose working with glass?
In part. Color is a big part of it, but glass also has a number of other qualities. It can be completely transparent, it can be translucent, it can be opaque, and the color is like no other material. So it has those qualities that immediately attracted me to it. I think I found that the processes very intriguing as well, and in my first year at Fine Arts at the University of Manitoba, I came across a piece that was actually at the WAG in the boardroom, which was a series of crystal spheres that were a lamp over the board table. And I thought, glass is such an incredible material to use as sculpture, but why isn't anybody using it? Because at that time, there were very, very few people, and certainly no one in Winnipeg. So I took it upon myself to find out where I could learn more about glass. And that took me to New York and San Francisco.
And while you were in those places, is that where you made the connections and were asked to do so many various installations?
Yeah, I've always loved architecture. A lot of my friends were architects, even as a student. And I love things of scale. While in California, when I graduated, I had the idea that I wanted to build very, very large walls of glass. And I didn't know that it had ever been done before, at least the things that I had in mind, I'd never seen anybody do. So glass blowing at that time was sort of the focus of the glass department that I was in San Francisco. And the head of the department, Marvin Leposky, was, as you mentioned earlier, one of the founders of the studio glass movement. And so glass blowing was sort of like the mantra. It was something that we were sort of pioneers in that field. And the idea that I had, I knew I couldn't do blowy glass. So I'd actually was quite good friends with Marvin. And we had, one day we had gone to a concert at another college in the area. And on the way back in his car, I broached the subject and I said, Marvin, you know, I really have this idea that I want to make really big pieces of glass, like giant walls of glass, very thick, very sculptural, but I don't know how to do it, but that's what I want to do. His response was more than I really could have asked for. He said, Warren, I always thought you had the best head in the glass department, so if anyone can do it, you can do it. Go for it. And so when I came back to Canada, that's kind of what I did. I never blew glass again. I just started working, developing my own techniques and processes to work on the scale that I envisioned and to have the sculptural qualities that I want to have in the glass. And so it's been a continual process of learning and developing throughout my whole career.
And did you use various things like dichroic glasses and how that would enhance your work?
Sure. Dichroic glass is a material that I'm quite fond of. It was originally developed by NASA, and I have it custom made for me in Portland, Oregon. There's a small producer there that has the equipment to do it. He's not the only one in the world. There are others that do it. But at this particular place, I can ask him to make it the way that I want it, the colors that I want. But dichroic, essentially, it reflects one color and transmits another, so that if you have a sheet of glass and you're standing in front of it and the sun is on the other side of you, it will be, say, blue. If you walk to the other side of the glass and the sun is behind you, it automatically goes into reflecting mode and it will reflect back gold or yellow. It's a complementary of whatever you see transmitted through the glass. You will have the complementary color reflected from the opposite side when the light is coming from a different direction. The thing that appeals to me about dichroic, obviously it's fascinating and the color is quite incredible. But another aspect of my work is a fascination I have with dichotomies. And when I have an idea of a certain dichotomy within a piece, which is usually within the context of the environment, the dichroic glass can be used to express that dichotomy because of its dualist nature.
That's fascinating. And what would you recommend for students that are looking to work with glass? And are there any particular works or artists that inspired your work that you would recommend they also take a look at?
Well, I think there are quite a number of artists that have inspired my work. They're not all in glass. But if one wants to work in glass, I think you should research and determine who it is that you like. And if they teach, go there, wherever it is. Unfortunately, it's not something that can be learned in Manitoba. So there are no schools here that teach it. So you have to travel, but that shouldn't bother anyone. Didn't bother me, and it shouldn't bother anybody else. There are a lot of amazing people in the world. And yeah, just follow your heart. Go where it is that you think you're going to learn whatever it is that fascinates you.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us this evening and sharing your insight and your advice, and I wish you continued success.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much. Great pleasure.
For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Alan Tait, professor and head of the Department of Landscape Architecture here at the University of Manitoba. Alan has a bachelor's degree in town and country planning and an accredited diploma in landscape design from the University of Manchester, England, and a PhD in architecture from Edinburgh College of Art and Heriot Watt University in Scotland. He has over 20 years of professional experience, is a fellow and past president of the United Kingdom Landscape Institute, and a registered landscape architect. Following 5 years' experience in local government and private practice in Nottingham and London, he spent 9 years running the Custom Landscape Consultancy in Hong Kong, Malaysia, Singapore, and Australia, before returning to Europe to lead the landscape design team for Euro Disneyland. Alan then spent 9 years based in London running Clifton Design and his own private practice. He has followed his research interests by designing, investigating, writing about, and lecturing on urban parks since the early 1980s. His highly regarded book, Great City Parks, was published in 2001, and the second edition of Great City Parks was published in March 2015 and received the Landscape Institute Research and Policy Award for 2015. Alan is here tonight to give us his perspective on landscape architecture. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
As mentioned, you have a diverse academic and professional background in architecture. Can you tell us about your training and architectural experiences that have been most influential to your professional development and your teaching career?
Sure. I don't actually have, I have a PhD in architecture, but my education has been more in planning and landscape architecture than building architecture, which means that I've been really working at the larger scale rather than the individual site scale for much of my career. although the landscape architecture has involved work on smaller individual sites as well.
So is there a particular innovative project you were involved in that you'd like to tell us about?
That I worked on? I guess the two that I probably talked to students about ad nauseam, and which I guess must reflect something to do with my regard for them, are running the project for Sha Tin Town Park in the New Territories, as they then were, in Hong Kong, and working on the Euro Disneyland project outside Paris in France. What would you like to know about them?
What designs and things did you contribute in the development of the, say, for example, the Euro Disneyland?
Sure. Well, I think more than anything, the important thing in terms of the approach that we took to, and I say we rather than I, in as much as I was running an office and responsible for a project, but not directly personally on the drawing board for, but part of and leading the team for that project, and indeed for the landscape of the Euro Disneyland project. So the kind of thing that we were looking at particularly was the human experience in engaging in a landscape, what it's actually like to be there. And almost, you know, although we're producing scale drawings, we're actually producing replicas of scenery that people will walk through and the experiences that they will enjoy when they visit those places. And that, to a very large extent, I think, drove our approach. Another thing that drove our approach was, I mean, landscape architecture is very much a contextual discipline, and it looks at the circumstances of its site and of the kind of people who might be using a project. And in the new towns in Hong Kong, as in the Hong Kong and Kowloon, the main original settlements of the territory, people are living at extraordinarily high densities. They have very little opportunity to escape, and very often there are three generations living in a small apartment. So we were trying to ensure that they had an opportunity in the parks that we developed to escape and get away and be able to enjoy having trysting places, meeting places, and generally having an alternative to the extraordinarily high density of living. That said, we were trying to develop a park in Sha Tin for something like 750,000 people living within a 15-minute walking distance of a 10-hectare space. So, you know, it was going to be extremely difficult to accommodate people, which meant that we tried as far as possible to subdivide the park without making it seem like it was a series of really small cut-up spaces. We tried to subdivide the park so that people would be able to escape from the surrounding city, and effectively, we could create simulacra of different spaces and places, and people would be able to take the opportunity to escape from the quotidian daily surroundings that they lived in. I think another of the important things that we did in that project was to go out and look at existing parks in Hong Kong and see just how they were used. Remarkably high proportion of young people using them, which is certainly what we were catering for in Sha Tin. But one of the other things that we noticed was that there was a lot of photographing going on, that before the days of digital photography, before the days of cell phones and selfies, there were nevertheless huge numbers of photographs that people would take of each other, particularly over the weekends. And so we tried to design in what we thought of as being effectively photo settings that people would look at and see the composition as being somewhere that they would like to have their Kodak photo moment. And I think it was the approach that we took to the design of that project that led to our appointment on Euro Disneyland. Effectively, I think the human experience, the being able to take people away from their everyday life and give them an opportunity to have an experience which probably in the case of a Disneyland facility is once in a lifetime. And if I ask students how many of them have been to a Disney facility and how many of them have been to Ottawa, it's generally more have been to a Disney facility than have been to the country's capital. And I think that the whole business of a Disney theme park, although, you know, it can be derided and the term Mickey Mouse is used as a way of diminishing the importance and significance of Disney facilities, they are actually quite remarkable experiences, and people who have been to them do remember them and do really enjoy them. On the one hand, yes, you can argue they're very manipulative. On the other hand, they actually are very liberating. And I think that it was because of what we'd done in Sha Tin that we were, as I say, that's why we were appointed in Disneyland. And one of the great lessons from Disneyland, I think, from the perspective of the landscape architect, was that the landscape architects have remarkable responsibility. All of the vegetation in the Disney facility is living vegetation. None of it is imitation, none of it is artificial, apart from perhaps the Swiss Family Robinson treehouse. And that, I think, was something that surprised us right from the get-go. But we were asked to use plants in different ways, and plants that people on the streets of Paris, for instance, would not normally see. So species like the paulownias, which are a major street tree in Paris, would never appear in Disneyland. And it was this sort of trying to give people an unusual experience, trying to create something special apart from the normal daily way of life that I think was common to both projects on a more extreme scale, obviously, with the Disney facility, but which I think was the common strand between the two.
And are those strands and those commonalities the innovations that drew you to some of the parks you wrote about in the highly regarded book in your field that Great City Parks described as a celebration of some of the finest achievements of landscape architecture in the public realm? Can you elaborate on some of the discoveries and what drew you to these particular parks?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of irony of Great City Parks is the fact that it's the book that we would have liked to have found when we started working on Chartin Park. In other words, there wasn't that much literature about parks at that time, and there was a kind of almost a running joke at first that when we'd finished building the park, we'd actually write a book about how to build parks. But one of the things that we certainly felt was that there was relatively little in the way of study of parks. And so the approach that I took to Great City Parks was really to try and do it despite the many different countries that the parks were in, was to try and take a consistent basis and look at it on a kind of case study basis, which is now becoming a very well-established academic procedure in the majority of the professional disciplines. I mean, it amounts to, in effect, best practice by looking at what others have done. And I think the lessons, in retrospect, perhaps I was going in there with certain prejudices, but in terms of the design, the kind of things that we learned were the real importance of continuity. The most, I don't like using the word successful because successful is a very value-laden word and success is measured against your own criteria. But the most attractive of the parks, let's say, and I know attractive is value-laden as well, of them is those that have had a continuity of the designers and or the management, that there has been a follow-through from the original intention through to the post-construction management and maintenance that recognizes those design intentions. And I think that this is one of the factors about landscape architecture that is somewhat different from other fields of environmental design, from interior design and from architecture, particularly building architecture, that is, in as much as our projects change over time, they change over the years, they change over the seasons, and we have to think about them in terms of management being something that is over a 20 or 30 or longer year time horizon. And that, I think, was one of the principal lessons that we learned, the lesson of continuity. I think one of the other things that is inevitably important and which we tried to work into what we did in Chartin, but which was reaffirmed by the study in the book, is the importance of location of parks. That, you know, people don't seek them out necessarily if they're hidden. They don't go and look for them so much as embed them into their everyday way of life. So to be, again, successful, in inverted commas, it's important that they feel like they are part of people's natural everyday life. And I think another of the factors that came out from the book, and which I think we were certainly subconsciously aware of in working on projects like Chartin and Disneyland, is the fact that the majority of sites are in remarkably poor condition when the landscape architects are commissioned to work on them. Chartin, for instance, was completely made ground. The way that urban land is obtained in Hong Kong is through what are called borrow areas, where basically mineral fill is obtained from surrounding hills and dumped into coastal locations. And so the site that we were working on was completely made ground in Hong Kong. And equally in Disneyland, we were working on what had been completely flat agricultural land with no landform to it. And so the first part of creating a place within which people could escape was actually to build the berm and shut out the outside world so that you had a completely enclosed space within. And I think that the point with many of the parks that I looked at in Great City Parks is the fact that they did have, for instance, industrial previous uses for quarrying or whatever it may have been, Or indeed that they were polluted sites with toxic materials on them. And so the image that people have very often of urban parks is that they are pieces of trapped countryside left behind when the city developed around them. Of the examples that I had, 20 in the first edition, 30 in the second edition, Stanley Park was part of the first 20 and obviously therefore the subsequent 30. Stanley Park in Vancouver is probably the only example really of a pre-existing landscape that was protected from development and gradually converted into being a public park. Almost all of the other examples were pieces of land that had to be in some way restored or improved in order to make them suitable for public park usage.
It gives it a different degree and an intensity that you wouldn't expect. It required a lot more work.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think that the skill is not purely one of putting a fence around something and protecting it. It's very much the skill of being able to work, obviously, with others, particularly soil scientists and chemists, in order to remediate the kind of conditions that we find on site already.
Another human experience in parks might be some of the increasing demand for sculpture parks and the developments of those in Europe and the UK and other global locations. Do landscape architects get very involved in the design of these?
Yes, quite frequently. In fact, I would think that almost, you know, most of the best-known sculpture parks are a consequence of landscape architects' involvements. If you think of places like the Krullemuller Museum in the Netherlands, the Yorkshire Sculpture Park in the United Kingdom, they have had landscape architects involved. In the case of the Yorkshire Sculpture Park, it was actually an English landscape movement, 18th century landscape, that was made over into a sculpture park. But yes, sculpture parks are very much part of the repertoire of landscape architects.
And what do you enjoy most about your field and teaching in the Faculty of Architecture?
What do I enjoy most? I guess working with the students, inevitably, hearing of student success subsequently. I'm actually on the jury for the Centre Ventures Market Lands competition, which is going on currently. And it was nice to see that of the five shortlisted teams, two of them, the landscape architects are students who were in the first class that I taught second studio that I taught in 1999, and that some 20 years later, they're coming back as fully fledged professionals to work on projects, major projects in downtown Winnipeg. So I suppose, you know, the difference and the distinction between being in practice is that being in practice and being in the academy is that when you're teaching students here, it's almost like you're going back to the very beginning of the process of running an office, in as much as you're trying to educate people so that they will be able to play a full role in the practice of the discipline. And I think the great pleasure of the discipline is the sense that you are both protecting and enhancing the natural conditions of the planet, and you are creating places that will add to human enjoyment, satisfaction, hopefully health, recreation, well-being of the citizens that use the projects that you design.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for being on our show and sharing your perspective on landscape architecture with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Susan.
Thank you. That was Alan Tate, Professor and Head of Landscape Architecture here at the University of Manitoba. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.